Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Brookings. I'm Martin Indyk, the Vice President for the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings. On behalf of our President, Strobe Talbott, and Jack Garrity, the Executive Director of the Asia Society, with whom we are co-hosting this program this evening, I want to welcome you all here. It's a very special occasion when we have the chance to welcome the Foreign Minister of Pakistan to Brookings and the Asia Society. Maktoum Shah Mohammad Qureshi was born in Muri, Pakistan, in 1956. He has had an extensive political career before assuming the office that he now holds as Foreign Minister of Pakistan in March of 2008. He was the president of the Pakistan People's Party and is president of Alliance for Restoration of Democracy in the Punjab. He's held several key positions, including spokesman to the chairperson of PPP under the government of Benazir Bhutto in 1996. He also served as chairman for Multan Development Authority, the Multan Policy Planning Committee, and the Institutional Reforms Group, and the Prime Minister's Task Force on Agriculture. The Foreign Minister is here in Washington today to lead the Pakistani delegation to the U.S.-Pakistani Strategic Dialogue. This is the third strategic dialogue that has taken place. The Foreign Minister with Secretary of State Clinton and her delegation. The Foreign Minister also had a chance to take his delegation to the White House, where he had a very good meeting with President Obama. And so at the end of what seems to have been a very good day of intensive discussions, ahead of a dialogue that will take place over the next 2 days between the U.S. government officials and cabinet ministers and Pakistani government cabinet ministers and officials on such issues as health, energy, agriculture, infrastructure, the intensity of the relationship between the United States and Pakistan will gain further momentum. This is especially the case because of the devastating floods that have impacted on Pakistan's people over the last few months. And Foreign Minister Qureshi, I'm sure I speak on behalf of everybody here in expressing our concern and condolences for those who have suffered loss of life. But those floods have given new urgency to the engagement that's taking place here in Washington today and over the next couple of days. Joining Foreign Minister on the panel is Richard Holbrooke, who really needs no introduction, I'm sure, but he is the U.S. Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, working tirelessly for the Secretary of State and the President in the efforts to try to turn the war in Afghanistan and the relationship with Pakistan to a positive and peaceful conclusion. He served previously as the United States Ambassador to the United Nations, as Assistant Secretary of State for Europe, and as Assistant Secretary of State for Asia before that. He was, of course, the chief architect of the 1995 Dayton Peace Agreement that ended the war in Bosnia. We're also very glad to welcome to the discussion this evening Dr. Rajiv Shah. He is the administrator of the United States Agency for International Development. He assumed that position December of last year, and as such, he has overall responsibility for the flood relief in Pakistan work that's being done, humanitarian assistance not just there, but worldwide that's undertaken by USAID. Previously, Dr. Shah served as Undersecretary for Research, Education, and Economics and as Chief Scientist at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, where, amongst his other notable achievements, he launched the National Institute of Food and Agriculture. Prior to joining the Obama administration, Dr. Shah served as Director of Agricultural Development in the Global Development Program at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And to conduct the conversation between these very distinguished gentlemen, we're very glad that Steve Cole has accepted our invitation to moderate that conversation. Steve is president of the New American Foundation, a contributor to the New Yorker magazine, where he informs us all, particularly on the issues, the complex issues of South Asia, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. He's twice a Pulitzer Prize winner, including for his book Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden, from the Soviet invasion to September 10th, 2001, which was a really path-breaking and very revealing book that has educated us all. So without further ado, Foreign Minister Qureshi, welcome to Brookings and the Asia Society, and we look forward to hearing your remarks.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Martin. Thank you for your introduction. As you all know, ladies and gentlemen, I'm here for the third meeting, the third round of the strategic dialogue, and couldn't have asked for a better start. The meeting with the President was very satisfying for me and my delegation. Ladies and gentlemen, it is an honor and a privilege to be at this prestigious institution. I'm thankful to the Brookings Institute and the Asia Society for inviting me to speak here this evening on the issue that is of vital concern to both Pakistan and the United States. I'm delighted that Ambassador Holbrooke and Administrator Rajiv Shah are also here with us today. Pakistan and the United States have been crucial allies and partners for more than half a century. Bilateral relations were never as close and with as much at stake as today. This lends added importance to the third phase of the strategic dialogue between Pakistan and the US, for which I'm here in Washington. This dialogue will define the future of our bilateral relationship. It will also have a direct bearing on the success of our struggle against terrorism and extremism and the future of the region. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a moment of a unique confluence of crises for Pakistan. A vicious and inhuman terrorist campaign has killed thousands of our people. Long neglected social and economic problems threaten our national structure. The international recession has badly hurt foreign investments and markets for our products. And on top of all, over the last 3 months, Pakistan has been faced with the greatest floods in modern history, a tragedy so huge that the Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, has called it a global disaster, a global challenge affecting more people than the Asian tsunami, the Kashmir earthquake, and the Haitian earthquake combined. Ladies and gentlemen, Pakistan has been a steady partner to the United States. We have a history of cooperation in meeting some of the great challenges of the post-Second World War period, the Cold War, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, and the establishment of relations between the United States and China. If the Cold War was the central struggle of the 20th century, the fight against terrorism and fanaticism has become the defining struggle of the new millennium. And in this historic struggle, Pakistan and the United States are once again in the trenches together. Ladies and gentlemen, we must all be aware of the enormous price that Pakistan has paid for its central role in both of these conflicts. Through the 1980s, the war against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, converted our peaceful country into a society infested with Kalashnikov, heroin, and sectarianism. 4 million Afghan refugees poured across our borders, and we gave them sanctuary and succor. And when the Soviets were defeated and left Afghanistan, the United States quickly packed its bags, leaving us to deal with the networks that all of us had jointly created. This was the beginning of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. In the ongoing struggle against international terrorism, Pakistan also paid a huge price. More than 30,000 of our civilians have been killed. Nearly 7,000 law enforcement officials have offered their lives. This is more than the casualties suffered by all the NATO forces in Afghanistan. And most painfully, to me personally, we have seen our greatest leader, Shahid Benazir Bhutto, assassinated by those who most feared her vision of moderation. Compounding these immeasurable human losses have been the colossal financial and economic losses, conservatively estimated at nearly $50 billion. Ladies and gentlemen, our commitment to the fight against terrorism and extremism is real and demonstrable. The Democratic government has spent immense political capital in converting the public opinion in favor of this struggle, a national consensus that was earlier lacking. As a result, today, for the people of Pakistan, this is our war. Pakistan has walked the talk and is standing up for the peace and security of the region, in fact, the whole world. Ladies and gentlemen, as if we hadn't suffered enough, next came the devastating floods. This has been a natural calamity of unprecedented proportions. For weeks and months, raging floodwaters ravaged our land and displaced our people. Over 21 million were affected. Over 20% of Pakistan's territory was submerged. Houses, crops, livestock, roads, bridges, schools, and hospitals were washed away. No nation, developed or developing, could have been prepared for a disaster of such proportions. The magnitude is colossal. It is 100 times the devastation caused by Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. This is what we face today. The mettle of Pakistani nation was tested once again, and our people have proved their resilience yet again. In the holy month of Ramadan, following Islam's finest traditions of compassion and sacrifice, the people of Pakistan opened their hearts and contributed as generously as they could. The whole Pakistani nation was mobilized with the government, the armed forces, civil society, media, and private citizens actively participating in the countrywide national effort for rescue and relief. This crisis and our response have demonstrated the indomitable spirit of the people of Pakistan. But we could not have been able to ferry through early relief and recovery phases without the support and solidarity of our friends. The truism of a friend indeed being a friend indeed was on display. The United States was among the first of our friends to respond. It was and is the largest contributor of humanitarian assistance in cash and kind. For thousands of Pakistanis stranded in isolated villages and hamlets, U.S. helicopters were the only means of reaching to the safety of dry land. U.S. Marines toiled alongside our soldiers and citizens as we tried to overcome this momentous challenge. Ladies and gentlemen, I take this opportunity to extend through you the gratitude of the people and government of Pakistan to the people and government of the United States for understanding and sharing our pain. Thank you. Now that we begin with the phase of reconstruction and rehabilitation of the flood-affected areas, we hope to receive the same cooperation and assistance from you as before. The U.S. relations with Pakistan in the past have been one-dimensional. The U.S. ignoring its most precious political and human values, many a times chose dictatorship over democracy. This no doubt contributed towards resentment amongst the people of Pakistan. They felt used and exploited. And this is now reflected in the findings of the many recent opinion survey. They show that an overwhelming majority of Pakistanis do not consider America a friend. This is what we now aim to correct. One of the most significant developments in that direction in creating a new era of relationship between the United States and Pakistan has been the passage of the Kerry-Lugar-Berman Bill. This commits $7.5 billion over the next 5 years to non-military assistance for Pakistan. The new law aims to build bridges with the people of Pakistan. It is a metaphor for this postulation that only an economically viable Pakistan will have the political strength and stability to defeat the terrorist menace that threatens Pakistan and the world. This new approach is not transactional. What we are trying to create is a long-term, mature, and mutually beneficial partnership. Ladies and gentlemen, let me be clear. We do not seek dependency. We seek economic viability. We need trade, not just aid. We would rather sign MOUs than IOUs. We need the United States to open up its markets to our products like the European Union has resolved to do, so that our factories can create jobs for our people and give young Pakistanis hope for their future. We need the United States to pass reconstruction opportunity zones for FATA. We want the United States to pass a free trade agreement with Pakistan, which will give a significant boost to our economy and industrial base. Ladies and gentlemen, may I also avail myself of this opportunity to underscore the importance that we attach to your support for Pakistan's economic recovery and sustained development. The elected government continues to pursue a macroeconomic stabilization program that has been chalked out in consultation with international financial institutions. We are in the process of reordering our economic priorities to meet the flood contingency. National resources are being mobilized for the massive reconstruction effort. We are also mindful of the need for a cost-effective program delivery. Accountability, transparency, and efficient utilization of resources is very much an important part of a government's agenda. We are determined to build an economically strong Pakistan. We have immense human and natural resources. We have talented people and technological competence. We have entrepreneurial abilities. All these are now being harnessed to deliver tangible results. Pakistanis are a resilient people. We have established institutions with great traditions. Our history is a testimony to the determination of the Pakistani nation in successfully overcoming multiple challenges at all defining moments of our time. Ladies and gentlemen, as with any sovereign nation, our policies are guided by our national interest. Let me clearly state that our national policies. First and foremost, there is no wavering in Pakistan's resolve to fight extremism and terrorism, as our nation has suffered the most at the hands of this scourge. We have stated that fighting terrorism remains a strategic and moral imperative with us. Secondly, the global fight against terrorism has advanced thus far essentially on the basis of international cooperation. Actions are required that reinforce and not undercut such counter-terrorism cooperation. We have stated it before, and I reiterate again, Pakistan's sovereignty is and will remain non-negotiable. Thirdly, Pakistan has a vital stake in a peaceful and stable Afghanistan. Respect of our legitimate concerns and solutions on the basis of common interests would be most durable. I have no doubt that we can surmount our momentary challenge with clarity and sensitivity about our respective commitments, concerns, and core interests. Ladies and gentlemen, Pakistan is deeply interested in a peaceful and stable South Asia. That prospect, however, is endangered again by the recent events in Kashmir. Any person of conscience cannot ignore the use of brute force against defenseless Kashmiri youth. In this unfolding tragedy, over 100 Kashmiris have lost their lives in the past 3 months, many of them teenagers. Their mothers are rightly bewildered at the deafening silence of the international community. Wisdom proposes that the aspirations of any people cannot be suppressed by the use of force. Such will be with the legitimate rights of the Kashmiri people. It is in the interest of lasting peace, stability, and development of the region that the US works for the resolution of disputes in South Asia. This has to begin with justice for the Kashmiri people. Ladies and gentlemen, as I conclude, I wish to stress that Pakistan-US partnership have profound consequences not only for our two nations, but for international peace and security. A heavy responsibility, therefore, rests on us to nurture it carefully. We need to build stronger public support for it in both countries. I reaffirm our commitment to contribute to this worthy cause and to make our partnership a critical factor of peace, stability, and prosperity at the regional and international level. I thank you.
Mr. Minister, thank you for those thoughtful remarks. Before I introduce Ambassador Holbrook, let me just give you a quick preview of what's ahead. It's a few minutes before 7. We're together until 8 o'clock. We're going to hear from Ambassador Holbrook and Administrator Shah in succession. We're going to sit down and talk amongst ourselves for a few minutes. At that stage, we'll turn to your questions. Please wait for a microphone and do just ask a question. Forgive me in advance if I interrupt any nascent speeches that might unfold. And thank you, Strobe, and Ambassador Indyk and Mr. Garrity for putting this together. And now we'll hear from Ambassador Holbrook.
Thank you, Steve, Mr. Minister, Strobe, and Martin. Thank you for hosting this along with Asia Society this evening. Two great institutions, one of which I was privileged to be chairman of for 6 years, and the other which I've been privileged to be abused by for over 30 years. I'm delighted to be on the podium with my friend Shah Mahmood Qureshi and with Rajiv Shah. And I'm delighted to see so many friends of Pakistan and of the issues in Southeast Asia, in South Asia, with us today. I especially want to single out two people. Ambassador Hussein Haqqani, one of the best ambassadors it's ever been my privilege to work with in this city, who represents Pakistan with such grace and skill. And our new ambassador to Pakistan, confirmed by the Senate a week ago, with us today, has not yet set foot in the country, but is already deeply immersed in the details of everything that is involves the relationship. Cameron Munter, who has stayed behind at our request, not gone out to Pakistan until the end of this week so he could participate in the strategic dialogue. And Cameron and I just came back from Brussels, where we attended the Friends of Democratic Pakistan. Today, we launched the third high-level meeting between the two countries in the last 7 months, all chaired on the American side by the Secretary of State. We call this the strategic dialogue, but you see that word applied to bilateral relationships between the U.S. and many, many other countries in the world right now. We have strategic dialogues with China, with India, with Russia. We have one with Angola. This one is quite different. First of all, there is no country in the world which Hillary Clinton has spent more time and given more attention to than Pakistan since she became secretary. And both she and the president have long personal prior experience with the country. As President Obama told Foreign Minister Qureshi today when they had an extraordinary 35-minute conversation in the Roosevelt Room to launch this very important week. And I'm so delighted, Mr. Minister, that you felt that this got the week off to a flying start. We certainly share that view. The three strategic dialogues in 7 months. Previously, the previous administration had something called a strategic dialogue, but it was chaired on the American side at the Deputy Secretary of State level. With no respect, disrespect to anyone in this room, that isn't such a high title. Nobody got it, Strobe. I'm sorry. You know, your President of Brookings was Deputy Secretary of State, but I guess they forgot that, Strobe. For Hillary to escalate this to the ministerial level was very important. For her to do three meetings, spend a lot of time in Washington in March and Islamabad in July and here in October indicates the importance we attach to the relationship. The president's meeting today was just another example. But even as the president was meeting with the Pakistani delegation in the Roosevelt Room today, there were senior and mid-level meetings going on in both the State Department and the Pentagon, which I want to discuss with you because I want to help you understand what we're trying to do here. This is not, as it was in 2006, 7, and 8, just a quick meeting of two foreign ministries. There are 13 working groups. Four of them met today. Nine of them will meet in the next 2 days. Today, the water group, the communications group, the agriculture group met at state, and the defense group met at the Pentagon. Tomorrow there'll be more meetings. The American leader of the water group, Under Secretary of State for Global Affairs, is also with us today, and she's done a magnificent job in an issue of the most immense importance to Pakistan, water, and that is Under Secretary of State Maria Otero. And I'm so glad that you've given us so much time on this, Maria. Now, these issues, women's empowerment, communications, the whole range, really matter. And the strategic relationship has been reimagined so that it is an ongoing, nonstop set of task forces in all of these areas. Communications group today reached some very important policy decisions, which we will roll out later in the week. So we're very proud of this, because when we talk about a strategic relationship now, we are moving from a transactional relationship which is what we inherited. Transactional was something terrible happens in Pakistan and you send over somebody to Islamabad and say you can't do this again or else. Now, sometimes those things still happen after the Times Square bomber, fortunately inept. We did send a high-level team to Islamabad to discuss the implications of it for U.S.-Pakistani relations. But we now embed that in a larger strategic relationship across the board. So what does all this mean? What does the switch from transactional to strategic mean? Why does it matter so much? Why this massive effort in both countries in the face of so much public dispute and debate about what the relationship is all about? Let me say, first of all, that we don't do this extensive effort with Pakistan because of the war raging on the western border of Pakistan and across the border into Afghanistan. To be sure, we're all aware of the connection between the war in Afghanistan and the situation in western Pakistan, and that is a very important focal point of the discussions we had. We met with President Obama prior to the President's meeting with Minister Qureshi. We met Raj Shah and I and our colleagues, met with the President earlier in the day to discuss these issues. But we don't work with Pakistan because of Afghanistan. We work on Pakistan because of Pakistan itself, because of Pakistan's importance to the world, to stability in South Asia, one of the most dangerous and explosive parts of the world, and for an effort to help the Pakistanis with a massive set of internal problems in which they legitimately should get the support of many other countries. All of this I would have said before the floods, but the floods are simply unimaginable to those of you who have seen it only on television. You've all seen floods on television, and at first the world underreacted. Floods in Asia was an old headline, but this was not just another flood. An area larger than Italy went underwater. Imposed on an American map, it would stretch from the Canadian border to Florida. Although deaths were far less than the tsunami and Haiti, as Foreign Minister said, the total affected area and the people affected far exceeded that. And we have just come back from Brussels with a damage needs assessment from the World Bank and the Asian Development Bank that simply to replace what has been lost will cost almost $10 billion. That's over and above the recovery, early recovery efforts. Rajiv Shah is going to talk in more detail about the floods, but I want to stress that in the midst of everything else, Pakistan was visited by an epic tragedy. There has been much criticism of how the Pakistanis responded, but I would ask all of you to bear in mind that just over 5 years ago, we, in our great nation, with our best communications and all our capability, a much smaller disaster became a huge domestic issue. And even to this day, the damage has not yet been fully redone. So let's acknowledge the fact that Pakistan, overburdened to begin with, has done as well as it could possibly have done, and that the leaders of that effort, including Foreign Minister's colleague General Nadeem, former General Nadeem, who heads the emergency effort, is with us in this effort. So, again, we support Pakistan not because of Afghanistan, but because of Pakistan itself. We support it because it matters, put simply, to all of us. Its stability, its reemerging democratic institutions, which have been under constant pressure and are as we speak, its ability to deal with its own internal threats, which matter to all of us for reasons you all understand, its immensely complicated relations with India, which go back to the origins of both countries 63 years ago. All of this matters to us. The foreign minister has mentioned Kerry Lugar Burman. That is an indication that the Congress shares our concern. A multi-year aid authorization, $7.5 billion, with the leaders having given us permission to redirect, to reprogram money as necessary for flood relief, and I would hope in the future we'll be able to backfill what we divert. But for the time being, we are going with Pakistan's priorities on the floods and other things. Kerry Lugar Burman is an indication of how deeply the Congress and the administration are united in supporting democratic civilian government in Pakistan. We inherited a policy that did not do these things. And while I recognize that our very attention to Pakistan has increased press attention and has left an impression of a situation that you all understand, it is our view that the relationship between the two governments has improved dramatically. When my first trip of the 18 I've made to Pakistan, foreign minister and I had a joint press conference. In fact, we've done about 30 of these shows in various capitals in the world by now. But in the very first one, the foreign minister used a phrase that I had not previously heard. He said, our two countries suffer from a trust deficit. And I'm glad to say that we no longer talk about that. To be sure, we have differences. To be sure, if you're a Pakistani, your view of the strategic interests of your country is not going to be identical to our view of the strategic interests in the region. That's inevitable. But we have found a way to have an extensive dialogue at the strategic level, back it up with practical policies like the $7.5 billion. When the floods hit, the United States was first in with the most. It's hard to give a clear dollar estimate for what we've done, but direct aid is in the $350 million range, but that does not count the costs of the helicopters that we sent over from Afghanistan and an entire shipload of helicopters off the USS Pelayo who went in, nor does it include our percentage of the funds for World Food Program, UNHCR, UNICEF, and other UN agencies. But when we lead, and this is something that all Americans should be proud of, when we lead, other countries follow. We leverage our efforts. And that's what we've been doing, working very closely with the Pakistani government. On the larger strategic issues, I'm sure we'll get into them in a minute, but just let me say that we have worked very closely with Pakistan in regard to the terrorist threat. As the foreign minister and I both have said many times, we face a common enemy, a common threat, a common challenge, and a common task. And while there is much more that can be done, and the press often focuses on that, and I don't question their right to do so, we believe that we have made a great deal of progress. And we believe that that progress has reduced the threat to our homeland while not eliminating it. And while, as I said a moment ago, and I need to stress this, we all recognize how much more has to be done, I want to be clear to you that as we talk about water and energy and women's empowerment and communications and agriculture, we also talk intensively and extensively about how to improve our mutual efforts against the terrorist threat, which the foreign minister so eloquently denounced a moment ago. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Foreign Minister Qureshi, Ambassador Holbrooke, Steve Paul, Martin Indyk, and the Brookings Institution in Asia Society, I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I also value the chance to be here with our new ambassador, Ambassador Munter, and Ambassador Haqqani, and Undersecretary Otero, who is leading our efforts in water, which is, of course, a critical part of both the flood response and relief and the overall strategic dialogue. I thought I might just share a few very brief comments on what the strategic dialogue has meant for our assistance program with respect to Pakistan, in full recognition of the fact that our assistance program is one small part of a much larger and much more comprehensive relationship that I think has been detailed extensively by Foreign Minister Qureshi and Ambassador Holbrooke. For us with the assistance program, the strategic dialogue has been an effort to essentially reshape both the substance of that program and the means by which we provide assistance. Substantively, most of the additional resources represented in the extraordinary five-year, multi-year Kerry Lugar Berman civilian assistance package has been targeted at the request of our Pakistani counterparts to the productive growth sectors of the economy in water, infrastructure, agriculture, and energy. And the strategic dialogue has been a vehicle for jointly designing programs and projects that align with Pakistani priorities. It's been an opportunity to reassess the history of U.S. assistance in Pakistan and learn lessons from those efforts so we can do things differently. And it's been an important opportunity to work on some of the policy reforms that go along with actual financial assistance in order to optimize sustainability and outcomes. In addition, the strategic dialogue has also been a way to change the way we provide the assistance. Instead of building parallel systems through independent projects and programs, we're making every effort to direct more resources to local institutions in Pakistan and, where appropriate, through the Pakistani government itself. In fact, we estimate nearly 50% next year of total assistance will be provided in direct assistance mechanisms, which is up more than fivefold from just 3 years ago. Of course, the recent floods have been a dramatic and tragic consequence for a country that was making very difficult but important decisions to expand its own domestic revenue base, take on some of the reforms that are required on the fiscal side to maintain the IMF program and improve its own fiscal situation. As Minister Qureshi highlighted, the floods affected more than 20 million people, perhaps 8 or 9 million of which are in really extraordinarily dire circumstances. It affected more than a quarter of total cropland and crop output for an economy, 65% of which remains fully dependent on agriculture. And the recent $9.7 billion World Bank and Asian Development Bank damage needs assessment is simply an assessment of what it would take to rebuild existing infrastructure as opposed to building back to higher and better standards. The U.S. government provided more than $400 million in assistance when you include in-kind assistance from military assets as well as additional resources provided through our various assistance mechanisms. It's important to note that while those dollars are significant, they, of course, are far short of what's necessary. But they do achieve real results. We've coordinated our work through the National Disaster Management Authority, which is an entity that has been stood up and allowed Pakistan to lead and direct the entire aggregate response to the floods. And General Nadeem has really done an outstanding job both leading that effort and directing assistance, especially from the United States, but also from so many other international partners, to those parts of the country and to those sectors that are most affected. We believe U.S. generosity has resulted in real impact for the Pakistani people. Our food assistance has fed millions of people. We've procured nearly all of the 7,000 metric tons that were procured from local food stocks, allowing for the creation of agricultural incentives that will enable a speedier recovery than otherwise would be the case. Our efforts to provide clean drinking water, of which we've provided more than 30 million liters of clean drinking water, have really focused on those populations most at risk for waterborne illness. And through really well-coordinated efforts with the Ministry of Health and the government of Pakistan and the establishment of a disease early warning system, have so far averted major outbreaks of cholera or other waterborne illnesses. And U.S. support for shelter efforts have provided shelter to nearly 400,000 Pakistani families that lost their homes in the tragic floods. Our efforts to purchase locally through the response, whether it's water purification tablets, plastic sheeting for tents and tarps, and basic food commodities itself, will hopefully help lay the groundwork for reinvestment in the Pakistani economy. And as we move forward, we're in an intense dialogue to understand how to best shape the assistance package to support the immediate recovery needs for Pakistan. For one specific example, we've been able to provide $21 million in additional assistance over and above the Kerry Lugar Berman spending envelopes to provide resources to allow the government of Pakistan to expand its smartly designed wheat seed and urea fertilizer distribution program so that they can help farmers plant for the winter growing season, which is critical to helping so many of these flood-affected communities recover as quickly as possible. But as we look to the future, real challenges persist. For just one example, recently the World Health Organization estimates that 420,000 children under five are at real acute risk of serious malnutrition. That will make them more susceptible to disease Of course, a state of chronic hunger for kids under 5 will affect them throughout their lifetimes. And these are the types of things that, of course, undermine the type of stability and prosperity that's in the interest of both countries. So we are committed to a broad-based partnership. We look forward to this strategic dialogue, as we have the last few, in fundamentally helping us reshape the way we have an assistance relationship as part of a larger program. And we do believe that now is a critical time. The Pakistani government has taken some actions to meet the IMF stabilization program needs, to improve their fiscal standing, and to move forward on issues like tax reform. Those are important steps. The United States has reshaped its assistance program to be supportive, and we continue to work with Richard's tireless efforts to get the world to recognize that now is a very crucial moment for the future of Pakistan, and we're eager to be as supportive as possible. Thank you.
So I'm a little uncertain about our plans for amplification from the stage. Do you have a... Am I all right?
No,
you're one on the back. All right. Well, while they're being mic'd, do it from the chair. Okay. So, Minister Qureshi, if I may start... at the 30,000-foot level, you, in your remarks, talked candidly about the history that has left so many Pakistanis disappointed in the United States and uncertain about the decisions of their own government to pursue this strategic alliance. You mentioned as well the price that Pakistan has paid in blood and lost opportunity over the last few years. When he spoke, Ambassador Holbrooke tried to make clear why the United States was willing to invest the time and take the risks to develop a durable strategic partnership. How would you describe why it's in the interests of Pakistan to continue to take the risks and pay the price that it is paying to develop this durable strategic partnership? Why is it in your interest?
Well, it is in our interest because we have a number of shared values to begin with. Democracy. This administration is a strong advocate of a stable democracy in Pakistan, and they have made it very clear that they want to see a stable civilian government in Pakistan, and it is in our interest to support each other in doing that. This government has a very clear strategy on how to deal with this menace of terrorism. And the government of Pakistan has, through a national debate within Pakistan, inside and outside the parliament, come to the conclusion that reversing extremism and defeating terrorism is in Pakistan's interest. That's another common factor. Third, this government feels that the United States can play an important role and use its influence in favor of Pakistan to help us achieve economic stability. And they have contributed. And one very significant demonstration of that was the help that we have received during the flood. The seriousness with which this administration is engaging with Pakistan is very clearly demonstrated that this is the third sitting we are having in 7 months. Now, that is the level of commitment. And the seriousness of commitment shown by Pakistan is through the vision paper that we have shared with this administration on issues that affect the quality of life of an ordinary Pakistani. We're talking about how to improve living standards, how to address the issues of poverty alleviation. Now, these are common interests. How to have, how to achieve stability in the region? There is a common recognition that Pakistan and the United States can become very useful partners in the attainment of regional stability. So there are a number of shared objectives. Do Pakistanis want Talibanization of Pakistan? Certainly not. So we have a common objective.
Mm-hmm. Now, just to anticipate a question that I'm sure is on the minds of some in the audience, you mentioned the commitment that Pakistan has made to fighting and eliminating terrorism within the country. Ambassador Holbrooke spoke on the same issue, and I think I heard him say more must be done. Is it your sense that the Pakistani state is doing all it can do? If so, and more must be done, where do we go from here? If not, what's the deficit?
You see, when we say more must be done, it is not just the United States telling Pakistan. It is Pakistan telling the United States as well. Shared objective, common goal. We have to make an effort. You have to make an effort for that goal. And today, let me share with you, ladies and gentlemen, we, in this very satisfying engagement with the president that my delegation had, a number of tangibles will come out, but the two very important deliverables were the president's firm commitment to Pakistan's economic growth, Pakistan's political stability, the president's firm commitment to a democratic dispensation in Pakistan, and the fact that he agreed to visit Pakistan next year, the fact that he has decided to invite the president of Pakistan to the United States of America, that is the level of engagement that is taking place. Now, there are concerns. Obviously, there are concerns. As the president of the United States of America, it is his job and responsibility to ensure the safety of American citizens. And I quite understand that. As a representative of the people of Pakistan, it is my responsibility, our government's responsibility, President Zardari, Prime Minister Ghani's government's responsibility to ensure safety of citizens in Pakistan. And many Pakistanis have lost their lives. I said 30,000 civilians have lost their lives. So here again, we have a shared objective, and our interests are converging. And this convergence of interest tells both sides to do more.
So it's been a while since I've been in the business, but I think you just made some news. Ambassador Holbrooke, about the president's visit, I meant. Ambassador Holbrooke, you constructed your vision of this strategic dialogue on behalf of the Obama administration long before the floods. If I heard you correctly, it sounded as if the floods had forced you to kind of change up a little bit of your thinking about how to approach American investments in Pakistan. If that's right, how so?
Well, that is correct, of course. But I do want to, before I get specific, to say how enormously pleased we all are, that the president has invited President Zardari to visit the United States. He was here in May of last year in the trilateral context with President Karzai. This will be for him and not for other leaders. And secondly, that the president will go to Pakistan next year, the date to be determined. But of course, you're right, Steve. We had a strategic concept. We understood when we took office that we'd inherited, frankly, a relationship in that we were very unhappy with. And we started by reorganizing. My very job to work on both countries while recognizing that they're each individual sovereign countries with their own culture, economic development, politics, was a recognition of the fact that they were that what happened in each country was affected by the other. This was not the way it was up to then. General Lute, who now has the same job roughly at the NSC that I have, was at that time in charge of Iraq and Afghanistan, two countries that had nothing linking them except that we were at war in both. and Pakistan and India were handled by somebody else in the NSC. Same in the State Department, where the desks reported to different deputy assistant secretaries, and throughout the U.S. government and all over the world. Because of our organization to focus on Pakistan in its own right, and we inherited a situation where there was almost no economic aid to Pakistan for a decade. We inherited a situation where a vitally important relationship to both countries had atrophied over time through a whole series of events, some lamentable congressional events that are over a decade old, another the consequence of the American abandonment of Afghanistan in 1989 when the Soviets left, and the consequences that unrolled in western Pakistan and led to the Taliban takeover and then 9/11, which you chronicled, of course, in your masterpiece, Ghost Wars. This situation had to be changed, so we developed the strategic dialogue. Foreign Minister Qureshi was really central in all that. It was his suggestion that we have a trilateral, we have trilateral meetings. We had two last year. We've had none this year because of the calendar. But I can say now again today, if you want to move the story a little forward, Steve, that we have been discussing with both Kabul and Islamabad a resumption of the trilateral process at the foreign minister level next year, because there was such value in it. And last week, the two ministers of agriculture of Afghanistan and Pakistan were in Des Moines, Iowa for the World Food Prize. Raj Shah was there. I wish I could have been, but I was in Brussels. And they worked on, and Tom Vilsack was there, and they worked on common agricultural programs, and that's going to continue. All of this was developing. And I think we were doing a pretty good job of overcoming a lamentable and complicated legacy filled with problems when the floods hit. Pakistan had 6.3% growth in the two preceding years. People didn't realize it, but Pakistan was moving forward. It's unimaginable, and we still don't know the full economic consequences of this tragedy. But, of course, we reoriented everything. And one of the most moving experiences I've had in years was going to Multan with the foreign minister, his hometown, where his ancestors are among the greatest leaders of Sufi Islam, visiting the shrine of his great-great-great times 36 direct. Is that the correct number? Is it more or less than 36? It was very moving, and seeing the desperate struggle for the recovery phase. Raj made a point I hope you all focus on. At first, the people were living on dikes smaller than this half of the room. You couldn't get to them. Helicopters couldn't land and get food in because they were so small. They didn't want to leave their land, but their land was underwater. Pakistani army diverted 70,000 troops to taking care of these people. Both Raj and I visited early and saw what an immensely difficult effort was. Then the water started to recede, and the press started to turn its back on it. Then, the minute the waters receded, people rushed home, but there were no homes left. Millions of homes are gone. The livestock was drowned. The crops, millions of hectares have been destroyed. We're beginning to get the first estimates from satellites. The roads are gone. Every bridge in Swat, well, there was $1 billion worth of aid in Swat last year after that crisis. All gone, all washed away. And Raj mentioned something I really want to focus on. In the early recovery phase, the people rush back to their land, and then they're in areas of stagnant water. And kids under 5 are going to die of dysentery very fast if we don't deal with it. And Raj and his teams, his DART teams, are out there working very hard under very difficult conditions. Other countries are all there. And then we have to look forward to the recovery phase. And Steve, what I mentioned about John Kerry and the Kerry Lugar Berman is very important here, because instead of having to go to the Congress immediately for money, which given the electoral cycle, they're out of session, money wouldn't be available for a while, we got permission to reprogram. And now we're looking to the Pakistani government to tell us what the priorities are. And Raj and I will meet their prioritization. We'll both be in Islamabad in less than a month. And in the meantime, we will meet their priorities, and then we'll see how much we've diverted, and then we'll sit down with the Congress and see where we go from there.
And I think all three of you talked about, in the recovery phase, strategies for economic growth. Minister Qureshi emphasized his country's interest in trade, not aid, although obviously a humanitarian crisis requires immediate aid relief. Administrator Shah, when you think about Pakistan's strategies for economic recovery, taking note of the strong growth they enjoyed prior to the floods, taking note of India's GDP growth rate across the border and the growth rates available in the Gulf and other surplus resource countries, what is plausible by way of trade and open border reforms in South Asia as a region and between Pakistan and the United States and between Pakistan and other partners that can be a focus of American support for Pakistan's recovery from the floods?
Well, you know, it's important to note that the Pakistani government itself has offered us, as the minister mentioned, a pretty detailed vision of what's possible on the economic growth frontier. And it's a vision that is characterized essentially by significant investments in an energy infrastructure that will allow for real productivity and economic development. It captures the potential strategic and comparative advantages that Pakistan has vis-a-vis agricultural production, high-value agricultural production, agriculture for export and processed goods, including textiles, which is a major source of export and foreign currency earnings. And so those are precisely the sectors that Pakistan was seeking to invest in and invigorate as part of a serious growth strategy. The transit trade agreement that Ambassador Holbrooke and the Pakistani leadership and the Afghan leadership put in place is just an incredible step forward, because it's one example of how Pakistan can benefit from expanding its trade relationships in the region. Recent news out of the EU and potential trade preferences in that environment will create similar economic opportunities. What's really tragic is that these floods occurred right in the core productive, the floodplain, the core productive agricultural part of the economy, at a time when that was the core growth strategy. And so we do have to look at what can be done on the trade side, on the preferences side, and with respect to opportunity zones to really enable growth in an environment where there was a coherent plan, there was a strategy that prioritized the core assets of the Pakistani people and economy and productive base, and now the floods that just have heightened the stakes pretty dramatically.
Can I just add one thing? Raj mentioned the transit trade agreement, and most of you in the room probably don't know what it is, and others of you think it's just a trade agreement. So let me just underscore something. It is an agreement for trade between Afghanistan and Pakistan. In and of itself, that's good. We think it'll bring $2 billion of additional GDP to the countries. But it's much more than that. It is the most important agreement between the two countries in at least 50 years, and probably since Pakistan became independent in 1947. People forget that the current relationship between Pakistan and Afghanistan was not born on 9/11 or in 1989. When Pakistan became independent and on August 14, 1947, and applied for UN membership, the only country to vote against their membership in the UN was Afghanistan under the king. And the reason they did it was because of the Pashtuns, and the question of who the Pashtun loyalty was towards. And so the underlying issues that still exist on the border had always been a problem. And in this context, the existing trade agreement, which was negotiated in 1965 between Pakistan, Afghanistan, and India, had never been carried out. So when the two presidents, President Zardari and President Karzai, came to Washington in May of last year, President Obama asked them if they would commit to negotiating a trade transit agreement which did not include India. Because we knew that if India was included, there would never be an agreement. 44 years of attempting to renegotiate it had resulted in zero. The Indians accepted this. They said they would go along with it, provided that if there was, that they, that in the future, if they came into it, Afghanistan would have what we might call most favored nation or national treatment clause. And after a very tense negotiation, we finished it at 6 in the morning on the day that Hillary Clinton arrived in Islamabad in July, July 19th. And Foreign Minister and his colleagues and some of the rest of us were up all night working on it that night as Hillary's plane descended towards Islamabad. One of the most important people in this, who I didn't acknowledge earlier, is is Ambassador Robin Rafel, who is the head of operations in the mission in Islamabad. And she spent those sleepless nights working on it too. So I want to underscore, Steve, that because I read in the papers a lot, but there's no strategy. There's a very clear strategy, but it isn't always easy. One of the core goals is to reduce the long-term problems between Kabul and Islamabad, which, as you know, precede but were accentuated by the events since 1989, or really since 1978. And that's 32 years of nonstop war for Afghanistan, which is increasingly embroiled Pakistan. And until the two countries have a strategic understanding of a common purpose, there is no hope for ending the problems which plague the whole region and are tearing Afghanistan to the breaking point, and which have required us to send so many troops and resources there. And the trade transit agreement, therefore, is much, much more than a trade agreement.
Can I just add?
Sure.
See, you have to realize that there is a new realization in Pakistan and in Afghanistan that we are neighbors and we will continue to be neighbors. The U.S. and many of the NATO allies are in the region for a specific purpose. They will not be there forever. But we have to coexist forever. So we need each other. We can help each other. We contribute to each other's stability. And this change of heart has led to a new understanding. And I think there's acknowledgement on both sides that the bilateral relations between Afghanistan and Pakistan have qualitatively improved in the last 2 years. Not just the transit trade agreement. Transit trade agreement is one manifestation of that. We have put in place an architecture for the future that goes beyond cooperation in the war against extremism and terrorism. It is economic interdependence. How we can, and how Pakistan, through Afghanistan, can get access into Central Asian republics. How Afghanistan can be useful to Pakistan to meet our energy requirements, you know, through a gas pipeline, through electricity transmission lines. So there is a new realization of interdependence, of trust, of confidence. So this is, I think, this trilateral, these engagements are now beginning to show results.
So that vision encompass India, as Prime Minister Singh has articulated, in your lifetime, do you think?
Well, Pakistan is very clear on that. Pakistan wants a very good neighborly relationship with India. What we are saying is we have outstanding issues. Both sides have agreed that dialogue is the only sensible way forward. We have in place a mechanism called the composite dialogue. That dialogue has shown results. Incremental progress has been achieved, and we need to pursue that. And yes, why not? I think it makes a lot of sense that if we improve relations, we have good, normal, healthy relations. India stands to gain. Pakistan stands to gain. The region stands to gain.
Questions from the audience. This gentleman here caught my eye, but please wait for the microphone. And
my name's Dennis Grubb. I'm more interested in the Delhi Islamabad dialogue than the Kabul Islamabad dialogue, and I'm curious why no one has talked about the bomb. What are we doing about the dialogue on the bomb?
Well, one thing we are certain, both realize we don't need to use it. It's mutually suicidal.
Yes, okay, well, the microphone is near that gentleman.
Dennis Cook from the Woodrow Wilson Center. I wonder, Mr. Shaw, if you would elaborate. You had said that aid is doing things differently in Pakistan. Could you elaborate, please?
Sure. Well, I think that the two most substantive characteristics there are, first, the level of consultation that occurs through the strategic dialogue actually finds its way all the way down through the way projects are designed and implemented, so that if I'd say a few years ago, it probably would be very difficult for the minister or the minister of finance to describe to you what the assistance program even looked like. Today, there's near complete alignment around what we're doing with Kerry Luger Berman resources going forward. And I think that plays out as well in the context of the discussion of specific reforms and policies that can allow assistance to be even more effective, generate better results. I think the second characteristic is, as I mentioned, a real focus on trying to invest in local institutions and local capacity, including the development of local capacity by doing direct assistance to the Pakistani government. And we have a statutory requirement, and we are fully committed to doing this in a way that tracks our resources and allows us to take account of how our money is spent. But the fact that we can do that with so many different parts of the Pakistani government is, I think, a testament to the fact that there are parts of the government that operate effectively, and is a counterpoint to the larger narrative that sometimes makes the case that the opposite is true.
Dennis, there's a backstory on this that Robin was very deeply involved in. When we started looking carefully at Pakistan last year, the Pakistanis of all political parties said the same thing. You don't consult us on your aid programs. And we don't see them. Well, we looked into this, and the criticism was absolutely right. So then this is one of Robin's key responsibilities. We try to really listen now. Now, there's still a lot of complaining because of the long time lags in between the time we make a commitment, the time we get the obligation authority, and Raj has about 14 hoops he has to jump through. Half of them are congressionally mandated, the other his own bureaucracy, expletive deleted bureaucracy. And but we are listening. The second thing is that Hillary and I and Raj concluded, upon the advice of the government and the opposition, that we ought to return more and more to big, visible projects, because everybody remembered the Kennedy and Johnson administrations. That's a long time ago. You remember them because you wrote the best book ever written on U.S.-Pakistan relations, My Bible, from 1946 to 2000. If you really want to understand this relationship, read Dennis's book. But the Pakistanis remember them, Americans don't. So Hillary said, let's move back to some visible things without abandoning women's issues or schools. Water and electricity, energy, were where we put our focus. And so we really have tried to listen. We still get complaints, but at least we're communicating now.
Next question. Yes, this gentleman here.
Brian Vogt with the National Democratic Institute. Question for Foreign Minister Qureshi. Clearly, this dramatic increase in aid is a very important development for Pakistan and for the United States. But there have been reports that have come out recently about the degree to which the Pakistani elite and the wealthy are not contributing with tax money to the Pakistani government. This is surely going to be concerning to American citizens who are footing the bill for the aid. What steps are going to be put in place or in place to ensure that Pakistani elites also have a stake in the future of their country and in their government?
Well, to begin with, these issues that are being talked about are not recent. There are some chronic issues that we are dealing with, and it's not our government. Consistent governments over the years, and I'm talking of decades, have not perhaps spent sufficient time in broadening the tax base. And I think there is a growing realization that if we need development, if we need growth, we need a national effort of resource mobilization. And for that, we need to broaden the base by bringing in more sectors that have not been taxed in the past, and to seriously document the economy. And I don't say this today. I'm on record having said it in 1994, 95, that there is a sector of the economy which is contributing something like 24-25% to the GDP, which is out of the tax net and should be brought into the tax net. And who should be taxed? The more affluent, the richer class, and not the subsistence farmer. So there is a thinking on that score. We are talking of a new reformed GST. There has been a debate within the country. There's a new constitutional arrangement after the 18th Amendment. There is a new formula of distribution of resources under the 7th National Finance Award between the Federation and the Federating Units. And today, in democracy, people are talking about it. People are writing about it. People are debating these issues. And that is what is healthy. And I'm sure we will overcome this problem within this government.
So a woman back there in the, to the left, her hand still up there if you see her over your right shoulder there.
A question for Foreign Minister Qureshi. What is a specific longer-term strategy to counter terrorism in Pakistan, and is there an end in sight?
Well, yes, because failure is not an option. And we see an end. And the end is that we will achieve our objective and we will defeat them and we'll reverse their trend. Now, do we have a strategy? Yes, we do have a strategy. How has that strategy come about? It has come about through a debate. And today we have a strategy which is called the 3D strategy, which is dialogue, development, and deterrence, a very healthy mix between the three. Have we put into use? Yes, we have. A proof of that is Malakand, Swat, and many, you know, adjoining settled districts in the KPK province. Now, that strategy has worked beautifully well in Pakistan and in the tribal belt, which is the strategy of clear, hold, and build. And that is working, and you will see results in the days to come.
Yes, this gentleman here.
Bob Astani, Stanford University. As we near our elections in 2 weeks, I think that the majority of my fellow citizens are very happy that the United States is supporting Pakistan and is able to be of great assistance during this period. But I think at the same time, Americans are very conflicted and very confused by what they see as a rather split personality on behalf of the Pakistani government, insofar as the area around what's generally called Pashtunistan. It's not clear whether the Pakistan government is supporting America's efforts in that region or not. And I think people are very, very confused about Pakistan's real relationship, what the relationship of the ISI is vis-a-vis the Taliban, etc. And I'm wondering if you can shed some clarity on that.
Well, I think there is no split personality. And if that is the case, then I think you need to do a better job with your public diplomacy. because Pakistan is very clear what our focus is, what our objectives are. The role the ISI has played is known to its counterpart here in the CIA, how positive the ISI has been. I think there is a conversion in public opinion. There's a change of heart in Pakistan, and perhaps that has not been fully appreciated in the United States.
The gentleman over here has been waiting patiently.
Noam Unger, I'm a fellow here at Brookings focused on U.S. foreign assistance reform. The recent aid branding controversy gets at a question of goals. In most places in the world, we don't have to choose between bolstering the U.S. brand and our relationships and saving lives and livelihoods. Both are in the U.S. national interest. Some argue that some parts of Pakistan present a rare and unfortunate exception in which a choice actually is required at present. What is best for long-term U.S. interests and the interests in Pakistan? Steady and, if necessary, quiet support for relief and development that potentially aids stability over the long term, or more limited but more explicit support that provides potentially ephemeral gains in popularity? And also, how does investment in rigorous evidence-based analysis factor into this strategic trade-off? Thanks.
I think you're asking about putting USA on the delivery of goods. If I'm just for the translation to the audience, yeah,
sure.
Is that correct?
It was a well-worded question.
Am I right
question.
About that? Yeah.
And I'm happy to take it. I think this is an important and serious issue, and not one that has an easy answer. But I will say, from my first visit, and I've now had three or four visits just this year. But in my first visit, I spent a lot of time just asking questions about, from political leaders at all levels, humanitarian assistance workers, and development program partners, and our own teams all over the country. And the one consistent thing I heard was that the Pakistani people valued seeing the handshake that used to, a long time ago, represent our assistance relationship, because it sends... It sends a message that we care. It sends a message that we're there. It sends a message that we're listening. And so long as we actually abide by those characteristics and put them in practice, I think on net, it makes the relationship stronger. And more important, almost more important from the perspective of an aid administrator, it makes the assistance more effective and more able to achieve results. In this specific case about how we've approached our response in the floods, we have a pretty consistent approach to how U.S. assistance is labeled and identified around the world. Our goal is to be transparent, our goal is to be visible, and our goal is to be supportive. That's not the reason we do the assistance. We do it because we care, we have a humanitarian priority, and we've been the first with the most support, both in Pakistan and in disasters all around the world for decades. But where there is an actual trade-off, if it's real and if it is meaningful and if it puts at risk the lives of the tremendously brave humanitarian assistance workers that are out there trying to save Pakistani children and help mothers deliver kids in a safe environment, we do offer exceptions to that general policy. We've been doing that consistently in certain parts of Pakistan where that's relevant, and we have been had that same policy in place through this effort. So, I think the quote-unquote controversy is a little overblown, but I think the more important message is, as the strategic dialogue demonstrates this at the highest levels, but really at all levels, visible, continual listening and partnership is genuinely valued on both sides, and it makes the assistance more effective over time.
Mr. Qureshi, I don't know if you have anything to add, but I also wonder, you mentioned American public diplomacy's deficits in Pakistan. Why is American public diplomacy ineffective in your country, in your judgment, if it is?
I think this administration is making a serious effort in improving that, and they have taken certain measures to do that. I think your
people were not perhaps dealing with a democratic government before. The media in the last 4 or 5 years in Pakistan has undergone a significant change. It's a much more open society. People are talking more. People are being more objective. People are being more critical. People are holding institutions and individuals more accountable. So the whole approach has changed, and I think greater effort has to be put in on your side to engage with all those institutions that were perhaps not required in the past. There's a parliament. You didn't have to deal with the parliament. Today we have a very vibrant civil society. Today we have a very independent media, and you need to engage. And I think Secretary Clinton has demonstrated that in her visits to Islamabad. She has engaged, and I see some faces sitting here. She has actually communicated and engaged with. She has been meeting members of civil society. She has been meeting, you know, sort of NGOs, students. I remember going to a very important event in Lahore when, there was some sort of a misunderstanding or misinterpretation of the Kerry Lugar Burman going into the Government College of Lahore, where students from all over the country were assembled, and they put very, very very, very searching and pinching questions. The way she engaged with them was what is required.
You know, this is a really important issue for us, Steve, and we recognize the validity of what's behind your question, and I greatly appreciate what the foreign minister just said. Our public diplomacy, to use that phrase, simply virtually didn't exist when this administration took over, for the reasons the foreign minister said. The Secretary of State and my colleagues and I really were concerned about it. There's been a complete revamping of the mission. Hillary has made absolutely clear how important this is to her. And the foreign minister has alluded to her trips, which really have been remarkable. And I would just share with you one anecdote which shows how extraordinarily effective she was, while stressing that even Hillary Clinton can't single-handedly change the opinions of 180 million people in the most free press, I think, of any Muslim country in the world. And when I say free, I mean chaotic. They're all back here, our friends. So in Islamabad on her first trip, right after Kerry Lugar Burman had been passed, there was a huge controversy over whether or not the so-called conditionality degraded the sovereignty of the country. Of course, it was not a real argument, but it was very contentious, and she waded into it, as the foreign minister has said. And at one point in the most contentious discussion, she simply said, you know, if you don't want the money, you don't have to take it. And it was absolutely a wonderful moment, and that quieted everything down. Then we came back a few months ago, July 19th, and we met with the same people, same groups, at LUMS and at the town hall meeting in Islamabad. And this time around, nobody was worried about that. They wanted to know how their villages and their towns could get part of the Kerry Lugar Burman money. This was all just before the floods. So this is a work in progress. If you look at the public opinion polls, America's pro-American sentiment has gone up, but it's gone up from 9% to like 20%. I could argue that's over 100% increase, but I don't think you'd buy that.
Right.
We have work to do, and we are going to keep doing it. And I could not agree more with the foreign minister and his critique on this issue.
So we've reached the end of our time, unfortunately. We could go on for some time more. Just to inform the audience, after we join in thanking our speakers, the group on the stage will exit, and we'd like to ask you to remain seated for just a few minutes as they get where they need to go, and then the staff here will facilitate your departure. It's been my privilege on behalf of the Brookings Institution and Asia Society to moderate this discussion. Please join me in thanking our speakers.